Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is writer Deborah Hampshire. Hampshire is the author of three books, From Blood to Verdict, Three Women on Trial, Women and Guns, Politics and the Culture of Firearms in America, and her most recent is The Rising Shore, Roanoke, historical fiction about the epic story of the lost colony in Virginia. Welcome to the show,
Thank
Deborah.
You.
Thank you for joining us. Now, I want to explore the terrain that your published works seem to have covered, primarily women who are daring and adventurous and women caught in our culture of violence. Tell us how you got interested in these subjects.
Well, first, I think it was just by happenstance. I had been at a dinner party and people were talking about the trials that had gone on in Ithaca, the early trials involving Shirley King as first defendant and at that point Christine Lane as the second sort of notable defendant. And a friend of mine said, I wish someone would figure this out. I wish someone would write about it. So I decided to head down to the courtroom and see what was going on. Of course, the fact that all three of the defendants I ended up following were women turned out to be important because it seemed to me after a time that the different portraits of these women, in particular the one presented by the prosecutor and the other presented by the defense attorney, echoed other kinds of exaggerations that you often sense or are present when people think about women or speak about women. And one was as the woman as victim, you know, she had no idea what she was doing, she was driven into it. And the other, the woman as villain.
Mm-hmm. So all these women were murderers, technically, right? That they all murdered someone.
Not Shirley King, no. She was, essentially, her son, Michael King, was the person who was accused. He was never tried because he died in a shootout with the police. Accused and essentially assumed to have killed the Harris family, mm-hmm. a family of four who lived out in Ellis Hollow. Shirley King was accused of helping him clean up the house after the murders, and then of participating with him in a shopping spree, a pre-Christmas shopping spree, using the credit cards of the Harrises. Mm. So she was accused of being complicit in his crime and of
So essentially an accomplice.
Right, an accomplice and a burglary.
Yeah. And one woman was accused of killing her child and another one was accused of killing her husband, correct?
One woman was accused of killing her child, yes. Christine Lane was accused of killing her 2-year-old daughter, Eliza Bush. But she was not convicted of murder, and they didn't bring murder charges against her. I'm pretty sure that she was convicted of manslaughter, got a sentence of 5 years. Deborah Dennett made it quite clear that she had shot her husband, Nathaniel Knappen, but she was acquitted, in part because she was the woman who was best connected. I mean, probably the most literate, the one with the most resources. Mm-hmm. And so she had a record of having visited doctors for bruises and injuries that clearly resulted from battering by her husband. So they used that defense. As I recall, George Dentist was very surprised he lost that case. And she was acquitted based on that defense, that she had been reacting to responding to a batterer.
And then self-defense, yeah. Now, some of the conclusions you made in that book are that the system is not necessarily justice, but two heated confrontations between lawyers and exaggerated portraits of the defendants. It's an interesting evaluation.
Well, it was trial is very strange theater. I really went down and started watching without having any background in having studied law, but I felt that since I was a citizen and this was, you know, this institution was there in part to represent me or represent my interests, that I could go down and figure out what I could see. What seemed to me this strange conflict between the trial's clear interest in establishing different kinds of dispassionate testimony so that the attorneys and the judge would be so careful in breaking up little bits of testimony and ruling what kinds of questions, how people should answer questions, what kinds of questions should be asked. The final effect was that of that was to take any narrative that somebody might have wished to tell, you know, the narrative either of someone testifying for the prosecution or the defense, and break it up into little tiny pieces so that no one was allowed, no one on the witness stand was essentially allowed to sit and tell a heartbreaking story or sit and tell a fierce and angry story, because that those testimonies were broken up and fragmented and made supposedly dispassionate.
Yeah. Would you call them manipulated, though?
Well, in a way, certainly. Once you sit there, you're at, I don't know if you would say at the mercy of, but you're certainly being, what you're saying is being controlled by the court and the rules of the court. On the other hand, there's this enormous effort to make things seem objective, in some way scientifically objective and dispassionate, not passionate, in situations where clearly passions are running high. On the other hand, then, you have this contest going on, the combat going on between the two attorneys. So on the one hand, you have an interest in establishing a kind of objectivity, and then you have these exaggerated portraits of the two women being, of the one woman who comes to seem like two women, exaggerated portraits of the defendant that are presented by attorneys who are clearly interested in winning and are willing to do whatever they can to win. So then you have combat and contest. And there were just some things that you would think would happen in a trial that simply never happen. For instance, if the jury, these people on the jury are the ones responsible for making the decision, you would almost think that there would be some time in a trial where these people would be given a chance to ask questions, to speak, to perhaps consult with each other so they don't waste a lot of time and present questions to different witnesses.
So, but can't they do that while they deliberate?
They can't. No, they really can't. You can't ask questions directly to the witnesses. You can go and ask to see certain pieces of the testimony again. You can ask for records of the testimony, I'm pretty sure. And you can certainly ask to see different objects that have been brought in as evidence. But you can't. The jury doesn't speak to any of the witnesses. Mm-hmm. And the jury never speaks to the defendant. So there's the people who will be making the decisions are really in some ways, they
sort of
certainly
kept in the dark
entirely
in some ways.
Passive.
Yes. Yeah. So what was your conclusion about your study in regard to these issues? Is the criminal justice system pretty much, would you call, unfair?
No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't come to that conclusion. The criminal justice system is just an extraordinary machine, extraordinary and interesting machine. I suppose perhaps the most disheartening conclusion I came to was the fact that at the ends of these trials, whatever there is of tragedy, however, whatever it is that we need to think about to really comprehend what tragedy is, had just been obscured, because part of what you need to do to comprehend tragedy is to put the two faces of a person back together, and really think about who they are. And about what has been lost and who's been lost. And what the trial seems to me to do, and this isn't, I don't have any real recommendations for ways to improve the criminal justice system or to improve the machinery of a jury trial, but what it seems to me to do is take a tragedy, an enormous human tragedy, which really just expands beyond the borders of anything we can grasp easily, and it breaks it into tiny pieces and makes it more easy to box. Makes it more easy to box and put away. So it provides closure of a kind, but it doesn't encourage anyone, for instance, to be to engage in any long period of self-evaluation. Do you know? Because for the defendant, the defendant comes to feel associated with her team of defenders. You know, the people who are defending her. So there's really very little opportunity for these people who have been divided into opposing camps to think about the middle ground, to think or acknowledge or, but, you know, a trial's really not meant to do that.
Mm-hmm. I don't want us to run out of time. We have a lot of material to cover. I want to talk about the second book that you published called Women and Guns, Politics and the Culture of Firearms in America.
Mm-hmm.
Quite apropos now, considering what has recently taken place in Virginia. Tell us why you wanted to study this.
Well, I started out thinking I would just study hunters. I always, because I've lived now in this college town for 20 years, I often feel that I am always talking to the same kinds of circles of people, you know, other academics, other people, fascinating people, wonderful people. But I'm curious about the folk who live outside the boundaries of the little circle of places that I tend to visit. So I wanted to study hunters. Then I discovered that, and I forget why I wanted to study hunters. I was just curious about it.
Mm-hmm. It was probably a culture that you knew nothing about.
I know nothing about, but I knew it was nearby.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And then I discovered that a lot of men were writing about hunters, and they, since they were hunters, knew a great deal more about it than I did. So I shifted my topic. And this was, I was doing this work in the mid-90s. And essentially at that time, the gun debates were fierce, and they were affecting politics. I mean, Bill Clinton in 1994 pretty much said the NRA was the reason that the Republicans then, with, you know, Newt Gingrich behind them, got control of the House. Soon after that, there was the Oklahoma City bombing, and then by 1996, Clinton had pretty much regained ascendancy, in part because he triangulated the whole welfare situation, the welfare bill. So he won back. He won that election when, for a long time, he was, you know, for a while, it's hard for us to remember, he was considered a lame duck president. Everybody just assumed he was out of there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the NRA was really powerful in the mid-90s, and people were making a big deal about discussing the role of women and guns. And the NRA was interested in using women as poster women to help their advocacy effort, their advocacy of what one of the main things they were working on in the middle of that decade was to pass a lot of concealed carry or right to carry laws. Now, you know, speaking of Virginia, Virginia has, you know, clearly has a right to carry law. I don't know if people are clear on what these laws were exactly. They vary from state to state, but basically what they do is make it very difficult for the courts or the police to get in your way if you want a permit to carry a pistol. They also often make it possible for you to carry that pistol into a large number of places that otherwise the city might have wanted to prevent you from carrying it.
But so how did your study about women, where did it take you? You interviewed women hunters and women victims.
I interviewed women hunters. I interviewed some women whose children had died. One woman, Tamara Meacham, whose son had been killed in an accidental shooting. I interviewed a number of women who were engaged in advocating for right to carry laws. One woman in particular who was part of a group called Swarm. So I interviewed women who had different opinions about guns, some of whom were very much interested in supporting and fighting for their Second Amendment rights to carry guns in order to defend themselves. And others who were strongly opposed to these right to carry laws. Now, by the end of that decade, 31 states had right to carry laws.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Deborah Homsher. Let's continue our talk a little bit longer about this Women and Guns, and then we'll start talking about your new book. So tell us what else you learned from this study about women and guns. They're basically for guns. Is that what your book was about?
No. What I tried to do, because there was so little of it being done at the time, was to just speak to women who had opinions on both sides, who strongly disagreed with each other, and try to figure out just how this argument was being put together. And also how these pieces of rhetoric, these pieces of inflammatory rhetoric that were being broadcast, I would say primarily by the NRA, how women then took them in and sort of tested them against their own lives and their own situations, and then kept some of the phrases and used them, these public phrases, and rejected others and sort of judged and tested others. I think that was true of women on both sides. You know, both sets of women, I'm dividing them fairly simply because they were actually women from all who had many different kinds of relations to guns and gun games. And I interviewed a few militia women down in Chemung County. All these sets of women would take some pieces from the sort of public discourse and use them to help them speak and to give them focus in their own arguments. And then they would switch them around and change them. And that's what I was interested in.
I think it's called talking points in politics,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, they were all looking for talking points. And after that, then one of the last places I went to interview was I interviewed women in Camden, New Jersey. Camden is fairly near Philadelphia. It's predominantly African American, and it tends to have a high gun violence rate. It's often not considered to be a very safe place to live. And these women didn't find that either the main talking points of the pro-Second Amendment rights folk or the main talking points of the pro-gun control folk really addressed their situation. If you were talking about, for instance, NRA's argument that what people needed was more guns to defend themselves, and if more people had more guns to defend themselves, then everybody would be safer. Well, a few of these women had owned guns for a while. One young woman said it just made her feel like more of a target, because once people knew she had a gun, then they were more wary of her and they were more likely to use a gun in dealing with her to defend themselves. Another woman just had a gun for a while to help make her feel safer in her house, and then finally she wrapped it up and threw it away because she didn't find it made her feel safer. On the other hand, this whole idea that imposing more legislation in the community and having more laws to stop the sort of spread of guns would help didn't really convince them, because there were so many laws already. So many of the people they knew were in jail. There was a lot of legislative control already being imposed on that community.
Mm-hmm. This is a subject we could talk about for hours, but I really don't want to run out of time before we talk about your latest book, The Rising Shore, Roanoke. You've switched from nonfiction to historical fiction. Talk to us about this book.
This book goes back to the very, very first glimmerings of what we think of as American history. And certainly when I was doing the Women and Guns book, I was just constantly running into people for whom the definition of what America was, where did it start, who are our heroes, who are the thugs, who are the heroes, was just a passionate and central. Because if people started redefining what makes a real American or what's sort of typical of an American, to redefine, for instance, former rituals, the hunting of turkey, the hunting of deer, now as somehow violent or despicable, or former heroes, Columbus, for instance, as now a thug, you know, a killer and a thug, That made people feel that their whole sense of them, not just of their country, but therefore of themselves, was under threat.
But don't you think there are some valid reasons why we should reevaluate?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Okay.
I mean, I'm pretty easily identifiable as a liberal, so I'm very much part of these reevaluations, you know, of our history, or not part of it, but you know, I'm curious about it. Mm-hmm. So this first event, the event that's central to this book is known as the Lost Colony. This was the very first English venture that attempted to establish a settlement in the New World. It landed on Roanoke Island, which then was considered to be part of this vast area of Virginia. Now it's part of North Carolina. There were about 117 men and women, just about 17 women, who were left there then by the expedition's leader, who returned to London to get some supplies. He was prevented from coming back for 3 years, and when he did return, he found the fort completely abandoned, and there was no clue about what had happened.
That's so amazing.
Yeah. It is amazing. It's an amazing story. It's the first English venture, and you know, just a mystery that has never been solved, although people have lots of partial explanations.
Yeah. And I wanted to talk to you about the fact that you seem to use the language of the time. How did you do your research on that? It's very interesting.
Well, there are a lot of records by early English explorers. There were two exploring parties before this expedition, and all the leaders of those parties were expected to write down what had happened and give it pretty much to Sir Walter Raleigh. I assume that he was the one who was financing these ventures. So you just read those things over and over again, and the sounds get into your head.
Yeah, it's almost like a cross between real British English and an Americanized version of it that we would think of has evolved to what we speak now. It's very interesting.
Thanks.
Yeah, I'm very interested in language anyway. But do you think of historical fiction as a valid teaching tool?
I love historical fiction. I'm Johnny Tremaine. Toss Johnny Tremaine in my lap, and I'm happy.
Who's Johnny Tremaine?
Oh, it's a story about the American Revolution. Johnny Tremaine he learns how to, he's a silversmith, an apprentice silversmith.
So it was historical fiction.
Yeah, it's a piece of historical fiction, very, very appropriate for, I'd say, middle schoolers.
Mm-hmm. So you think it is appropriate? I know you've taught, and I was just wondering if you think historical fiction is valid.
Any writing of history requires some imagination. You have to at least begin to imagine all the pieces that are missing, because there will always be pieces of the puzzle you're missing.
Mm.
And without an imagination, I don't think you can be a competent historian. So, in my opinion, what is good historical fiction, and I can't pretend to describe, to elect my own book as good historical fiction, but good historical fiction, all I have is a truism. It just helps bring things to life. And I think it makes people aware of, the kind of phantom neighborhoods and folk who are around them and who are still in some ways alive near them, that mm-hmm. places that were
you're talking about ancestors
and villages that have disappeared but used to be here, people who have disappeared but used to be here, and how the histories of all these people have really to a surprising extent have contributed to shaping who we are and contributed to shaping our culture. Mm-hmm. The immigrant experience, one wave after another of immigrants who come to the U.S. And this was, of course, it wasn't the U.S. then in 1587, but this was the first, these were the first English men and women to touch here, hoping to settle, hoping to start a city.
Mm-hmm. Is there anybody still doing research on what became of this colony?
Oh, many, many people. Mm-hmm. This year, probably the main focus is on Jamestown. This is the 400th anniversary of the founding of Jamestown in Virginia. And that's considered the first successful British-English settlement. The men who founded Jamestown landed 20 years after the lost colonists in 1607, so now 2007, 400 years. The archaeological research going on in Jamestown is extraordinary because they've actually discovered the skeleton of the old fort. They've found places where these posts were in the ground, and so then they know where to dig to find all these other objects, these artifacts. So there's also still archaeological research going on concerning Roanoke. It's mm-hmm. harder there because you don't really know where the fort was.
Yeah, I was going to say, did you go visit while you were writing this book?
I visited twice. I also visited Jamestown because that's where they have the best replica of the kind of ship that the colonists would have used.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to go on the ship. Yes, and I went to essentially it's called Fort Raleigh. So if you're interested in seeing as much as you can about the place where these colonists first tried to settle, then Fort Raleigh is the National Historic Park that you want to hit.
Mm-hmm. And did you feel the ghosts of some of these people that you wrote about when you were there?
Not as much as I hoped to. You don't really feel ghosts very much until you start to write.
Mm.
And then if you write something really bad, then they leave you. And then you wait for them to come back.
Tell us what you're working on now. Anything?
Right now, I am working on a comic novel about a woman approximately my age who's a librarian who is just trying to figure out what to do since her son has grown up. So she
This could be unprecedented, a comedy about a librarian.
Right. I know. She's a very sharp librarian. She's very sharp. She's probably got a little more imagination than is good for her. And her ex-husband has come back to town.
Oh.
So
this is going to be pure fiction for you for the first time, right?
Pure fiction, yeah. Well, contemporary fiction.
Yeah, as opposed to historical fiction or nonfiction.
Uh-huh. Yes. Doing historical fiction is exhausting. You have all these details that you've learned, and when you first try to hammer down a sentence, these details leap out of it.
Mm.
And then he picked up the leather mug with the, and then he put it on the table next to the fact that, look, he doesn't have a fork, and then he did, you know.
So fiction, you can just let yourself go wild.
Yeah,
that's
contemporary
great.
Fiction, of course, you know, all the details are right in front of your eyes, so.
Deborah Hampshire, we have run out of time. I thank you so much for joining us. And I would recommend people reading The Rising Shore, Roanoke. It's a very interesting book, and I think anybody who's interested in history would be very interested in this. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tish. I really appreciate it.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by Finger Lakes Arts Grants and Services. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.